Today on the LA Food Podcast, I'm your host, Lucas Servodio, hoping to bring you a little bit of levity and deliciousness at the end of what's been, let's be honest, another tough week for the human species. We're joined today by the indomitable Bricia Lopez, a widely respected entrepreneur and author whose family restaurant, Gelaguetza, has been enchanting the palates of Angelenos with Oaxacan delicacies for nearly three decades. Bricia joins me to discuss the restaurant's origin story, how she and her siblings helped save it from bankruptcy 10 years ago, and what it means to uphold Gelaguetza's legacy while working to keep things fresh and exciting. We get into the ins and outs of mole and why you should never even think about calling it a chocolate sauce, and Bricia even gives us a rundown of how to spend the ideal weekend getaway in Oaxaca. It's a treat of a conversation, and I can't wait for you to listen to it, dear listener. But first, Father Saul swings by to chop up some of the biggest headlines in the food world. We talk about a couple of fascinating new developments coming to a sleepy corner of Chinatown, a troubling new twist in California's service fee saga, and the first signs of a potential Mario Batali comeback. Please hold while I vomit. Most importantly, though, I get to vent about an LAist article that felt a bit like a personal insult. And if you think that sounds dramatic, just you wait, dear listener. Without further ado, let's chow down. Welcoming back to the pod, a man whose title may be father, but who's very much the prodigal son of this here podcast. It's Father Saul. How you doing today, Father Saul?
I'm doing great, man. It's good to be back.
Yeah, thanks for dating us with your presence. Where have you been all our lives?
Where have I been all your lives? Well, I've been busy recently. I've been hopping around, checking out new cities, busy with work, busy with personal travel. It's been a good time.
Yeah, I feel like our listeners feel a little neglected, honestly, by you. I've gotten some messages. Hey, where's that guy at? I don't really like any of his takes, but I miss his baritone voice. It's oddly soothing. So I think some folks will be happy to have you back.
Hey, gotta give the people what they want. And if it's dulcet tones, I'm here.
Yep, gotta give the people what they want. Speaking of what the people want, are you happy to have the Philadelphia 76ers back in your life?
Oh, you're just reminding me that I was planning to put the game on in the background while we did this, but I forgot, which is good for my overall focus and emotional well-being during this time. So yes and no will be the answer. Apparently some drama went down today. I don't want to talk about it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about your recent travel, Father Saul. So you did mention, you did come to Los Angeles recently, and you came for, it was a bachelorette party, right? And I think that the only thing more debaucherous than a guy going to Vegas for a bachelor party is a straight guy going to West Hollywood for a bachelorette party. So, but that was not part of our visit together. We did encounter each other during your recent visit. However, it was a complete surprise to me.
Yeah, that's right. Me and your wife conspired to surprise you at Checker Hall in Highland Park or Eagle Rock. Which one?
Highland Park. Come on, dude.
Oh yeah. I mean, look, I'm only a LA visitor, man. I don't know where I'm at. But we conspired to surprise you, which went off brilliantly well. When I showed up behind you with my suitcase straight from the airport, with you having no idea that I was coming to Checker Hall, you turn around slowly, as if you were in a horror movie and were about to get killed. There was a look in your eye of pure fear. You had no idea what was going on, but it was a blast.
Yeah, my wife really pulled this one off. She told me that we are going to go down to Checker Hall to meet up with some friends of hers who I don't know very well. And, you know, me being the supportive partner that I am, I was like, yeah, sure, it's a random Wednesday night. We've both had long days at work, but I'm game. I'll do whatever. So she perfectly places me in a manner in which I cannot see the entrance of the restaurant. And I literally am so excited about Checker Hall. It's a beautiful place. Like it's giving like a, you know, New Orleans, like Southern vibe. And I'm like, you know, who'd really like this spot? It's Father Saul, a famous, you know, Southern file. And not 2 minutes after I've said that, I hear whispered in my ear, I hear this is a place I should check out. And it's your booming tone behind me. It was truly one of the most, you know, scariest slash most effective surprises that anyone's ever done on me.
It was so perfectly timed that you said that. She literally texted me as soon as you mentioned that you wanted me to check that spot out because it's just perfect timing. And Checker Hall, by the way, had you guys been before? Remind me.
First time.
Really a great spot. Great vibe, high ceilings, and very, very solid food, I thought.
Yeah, you got like a whole fried fish and a salad.
Hell yeah. I think a whole, was it a branzino? It might have been branzino. I can't quite remember. But a really good salad and a great fish. I'm really in a fish era, a little fish moment Father Saul's going through right now. But it hit the spot. I mean, to be fair, I hadn't eaten all day, so maybe anything would have been good. But really solid, great vibes, great spot I'd like to go back to.
Yeah, well, I tried your fish. It was truly excellent. How did it compare to the Poltergeist fried fish?
Entirely different experience. Hard to compare. I'd say Checker Hall is more of the standard experience when you're getting a whole fried fish, and Poltergeist is, as always, whole different world of food and flavor.
Whole different beast. Any other memorable meals you had that weekend?
The one I would point out, Bestia. Went back down to Bestia. Still hits. Same as always. Still a great time. It was like a pilgrimage back to where it all began in some ways for us in our food journey.
Yeah, do you remember the one meal you and I had at Bestia when we were still roommates, and it was toward the end of your roommate tenure? And I think it was actually to like almost celebrate the end of our roommate tenure. And in the way back from the Uber, we like really opened up to the Uber driver about you moving, and the Uber driver got like really emotionally invested in you not leaving.
Yeah, I remember that. I remember we were like kind of. We were making fun in some ways. We were like kind of bullshitting him a little bit, but he got really invested in like the overall arc and story of the relationship, which is very sweet. I also remember from that dinner critically, we were playing the game we like to play at Bestia and some other restaurants sometimes, where we each secretly order to the waiter. We're real pains in the asses, and basically each of us takes a look at the menu and then whispers to the waiter what we're going to order, and the other person at the dinner does not know what has been ordered, and so it's a surprise as the night unfolds. Really fun to do. Really probably gets our food spit on by everyone in the back kitchen because we're so high maintenance. But at that dinner, we go one by one, and the waiter's like, you guys just picked the same exact dishes. And it was like a real moment of like true brotherhood ordering the exact same shit at Bestia.
Yeah, it's like women when they live in the same dorm and their period starts sinking.
It's exactly
us,
like that.
It was exactly like that, except for us, it's just our Bestia order synced, which, you know, don't underestimate the value of that, okay? Hey, I have a request for you. Next time you're in LA, can we get Instagram story reviews of like in-depth story reviews of your restaurant experiences, a la Max Shapiro of our you know, friends at the Air Jordan Food Podcast?
Oh, absolutely. I'd love to. You know, it's funny now, having become an avid follower of Max, every time I go, literally last night, my girlfriend and I went to a pop-up in Seattle called Amino, whose theme is fermented food. It's all the foods that kind of like fermented style. I won't lie, it was not for me. I thought most of it was pretty bad. And in my head was Max Shapiro going, this dish simply does not have balance. I know food better than anyone. I know all the best food, and this food's no good. And I just had it. I had like a Tom Colicchio voice, because it was also a pop-up. I realized it's kind of like a Restaurant Wars experience on Top Chef, where you're like, all right, here's the name of the place, here's the concept, here's what they're attempting to do. You're assessing whether or not they nailed it. So I have a Top Chef voice from Tom Colicchio, and like a devil Max Shapiro voice, where it's like, I am the only person who's ever eaten food on the planet Earth, and I know exactly what I'm talking about, and all you assholes don't.
Yeah. And you just start yelling productos, productos, productos at the top of your lungs in the restaurant.
You, fuck you, 50 best. Fuck you, world 50 best. What do you know? Yeah.
All right. I might have to edit this out, but we'll see. Look, speaking of things that get under our skin, I wanted to talk about an article that LAist published this week about a guy who ate 100 burgers. Now, here's the thing. This guy ate 100 burgers over the course of, wait for it, 8 years. 8 years. That means probably like when Trump was just entering office, this man started eating burgers. No. Trump was a one-term president. What am I saying? This guy started when Obama was in office, okay? And he just finished eating 100 burgers, and the dude gets written up in LAist. Do I have to remind the people what I do on a regular basis, Father Saul?
I think you do, and I want you to say it again just now because this was so fucking funny.
What do you mean?
I mean, look, dude, I bet next year you're going to eat 100 burgers in a year if the polls go the way they seem to be going for like year over year. And I was like, dude, I've eaten 100 burgers in the last 8 years. I just the fact that this guy got a write up for something that like people probably just kind of do, and you are explicitly doing in 1 year's time for different cuisines, and it feels like a total troll job by LAist, and I love it.
Yeah, so listener, for those of you who don't know, my like shtick on Instagram and on TikTok for the last couple years has been every year I set out to try 100 different versions of a specific type of food. So in 2021, I did 100 different pizzerias around Los Angeles. Last year, I did 100 different taquerias. And this year, I'm doing 100 epic sandwiches. Now, you know, some people have pointed out to me that eating 100 sandwiches in a year isn't that impressive because it's basically like you're just having lunch every 2 or 3 days, which is like, you know, normal. That's what most normal people do. However, if that's not impressive, then how is eating 100 burgers over the course of 8 years impressive? Like it just, you know, look, I'm a big fan of LAist, Gob Chabran, the editor over there. I consider him a friend, huge respect for him. So really, this is really a come and get me plea. You know, like I'm here. I'm doing the work. Come and get me.
Dude, 100 burgers over 8 years is a burger a month. Like I think most people in LA have eaten more than 100 burgers in the last 8 years. Now, the cool thing about this guy that they profiled is that like, yeah, whatever, it's all due outlets and he has particular like rules that they follow or whatever for trying the burgers out. I don't know, man. The fact like this is too funny that you're out there in LA eating shitloads of food and they were like, hey, you know what's cool? A guy who eats less than that. Let's talk about that guy.
Part of me thought like, okay, 100 burgers is a lot of like calories and saturated fat. And I do think we have like an obsession, a weird obsession with watching people eat large amounts of like unhealthy food. It's why like Man versus Food was so popular, right? But you know, when you spread that over the course of 8 years, I mean, you know, this he may have like the cholesterol of like a newborn, you know, because it's nothing.
It's a pretty healthy diet. One burger a month is pretty well balanced, man.
Yeah, it's like his cheat meal. His cheat meal. Yeah,
exactly.
Well, okay. Speaking of people who are trolling, I want to talk about Mario Batali. Do you know who Mario Batali is?
Oh, he's one of my favorites.
One of my favorites.
No, actually, well, yeah. Wait, before you go on, because you're gonna talk about Eater article that recently came out. I just want to say this. I fucking hate Mario Batali. And that before the Me Too thing dropped, where he got canceled, and we might go into like what all the allegations were and blah blah blah, I went to the LA Food Festival Jonathan Gold hosted before his passing, and I watched a panel with Mario Batali, Massimo Bottura, Roy Choi was there. I was watching this panel play out, and Mario was such a slimeball. There was one a woman chef there who was like oh my god, her name's gonna slip my mind, but it was these three guys and a female chef from Los Angeles, and Mario was such a sleazeball to her and so like patronizing and like shitty that I left that thing being like, that guy's definitely a piece of shit. Lo and behold, a year later, what do we hear? Mario Batali, confirmed piece of shit.
Well, can you talk a little bit about in what ways he was confirmed as a piece of shit?
Yeah. So if I recall correctly, he basically inappropriately groping, sexually harassing, and you know, borderline assaulting women. I think it was at this famous New York establishment. They would have these rowdy parties, and he would like feel girls up and grope them and stuff like that. I think that's what he officially got like accused of. I think he settled out of court, and of course has basically for the most part left the public eye, not before dropping one of the best Me Too apologies of all time, where he was basically like, sounds like I might have done that shit. My bad, bro. By the way, check out this recipe for pizza dough cinnamon rolls. the all-time Me Too apology.
Yeah, the dude put out like a regular version of his newsletter, and like at the top he was like, it's true, I did it. And then at the bottom he follows it up with a recipe. Truly like
one of the most unhinged ways to post a Me Too apology, but it has gone down in history. In fact, the Eater article talking about his quote unquote comeback even references the cinnamon roll gate, we'll call it.
Yeah.
So basically what's happening is he has posted a couple of Instagram posts insinuating that he's going to be coming back with quote unquote virtual events. It's clearly an attempt to come back, maybe make a little money, get his name back out there. What the hell would a Mario Batali virtual event consist of?
I have no idea. This is what the kids are calling DeLulu, I've learned recently. Means delusional. My girlfriend downloaded TikTok. I've seen like my first 4 TikTok videos. I'm learning a lot. Yeah. Mario Batali is DeLulu, bro. Why? Like, first of all, he was like, and the Eater makes this point that he was like losing relevance even before the scandal. And at this point, he's been gone for what, I don't know, 6 years or so, and is completely not missed. And the guy is also rich, right? Like, say whatever you will, like cancellation stuff. The guy is still like God, like. Richer than like whatever 99.999% of humanity, but still feels the need, still feels like such a like a weird, insane desire to like be in the public eye that he's doing virtual events that will probably just be like weird Zoom cooking classes. I don't know what the virtual events are going to be. Guess what? I'll go a little farther. They're not going to happen. I don't think they will happen in the end. Like, this is another, he's floated trial balloons of trying to do comebacks, I think, before in the past, and no one wants this guy. So, yeah. That's what I got to say about Mario Batali virtual events, man.
Yeah, I think the only way he's coming back is if he goes full red pill and just, like, tries to market himself as, like, the MAGA chef. And it's
right,
like,
yeah.
You can't cancel me. Join my virtual event and learn how to make MAGA cinnamon rolls.
Yeah, honestly, that's probably the best PR angle you could probably take. That's the instincts coming out. And you're like, look, I don't think that's what he's doing, but I think you're exactly right that's the only way he could do it.
Yeah. It's there's not exactly an audience for Mario Batali virtual events in polite society, at least. Look, we're going to talk about something a little bit more serious, and we're going to move to LA to do this. There was a really interesting story that published in the Los Angeles Times this week. So kudos to the Los Angeles Times for actually doing some journalism. It was published by someone by the name of Emily Wilson, and the story explores a situation that's happening in Victor Heights. First of all, have you ever heard of Victor Heights?
I actually haven't, which apparently is not uncommon.
Yeah, so I hadn't either, actually, until on my sandwich crawl, which is very impressive, in which I'm eating 100 sandwiches in 100 sandwiches in 365 days, unlike people who do it over the course of 8 years. I went to a deli called Eastside Deli, which is in a little pocket of sort of like right between Chinatown and Echo Park. And it was an Italian deli, very popular, been there for like 50, 60 years or something like that. And that was the first time I realized this little pocket of Los Angeles is called Victor Heights. And I looked around and I was like, okay, there are some cool like coffee shops popping up here. You know, there's some like nice looking restored buildings and whatnot. It turns out what I was seeing is very much part of like an intentional movement into developing Victor Heights in a very specific way. So it's being led by a developer and an architect by the name of Jingbo Liu. And he is basically turning like a cluster of homes into something called Alpine Courtyard, which he's dubbing a culinary hub. He's basically giving each like individual home to a business. One is a coffee shop, one's going to be a bakery. There's a very popular new lunch restaurant that's operating there called Perilla. Actually, Bill Addison just wrote about it, just reviewed it properly in the Los Angeles Times. And starting next year, there's actually going to be like a proper restaurant opening up in a converted Victorian home, which I think sounds pretty dope. The interesting thing here is that in parallel to this sort of development, there's also like developments taking place that are the more traditional, like, you know, prefab, key fob, young urban professional buildings with like, you know, retail on the bottom, mixed use development that you're seeing popping up in every single gentrifying neighborhood in Los Angeles. But these are being held up as like two very different ways of approaching like the changing face of a neighborhood. Basically, the former way, this like alpine courtyard that Mr. Liu is spearheading, he's trying to do it in a way that sort of like kind of keeps intact the spirit of the neighborhood. He was inspired by like old images that he saw of Victor Heights that showed like these Victorian homes interspersed with like homes that also like sold products and were businesses and whatnot. So he's basically trying to keep or to sort of like recreate that vibe in Victor Heights. This struck me as really interesting because we've talked a lot about gentrification in Los Angeles. And the article kind of asks the question, is this guy finding a way to quote unquote gentrify respectfully? That's my words, not theirs. But it got me thinking, gentrification is happening. If it's going to happen, is this the way to do it?
Yeah, it was a really interesting article and an interesting, it's an interesting development that's being led here. And to the question you're asking about like, look, if it's going to happen, is this the way to do it? I don't know. Because I don't know if we should just be like, well, it's going to happen. And so there we go. However, so there, I think two key things that are being attempted here. One is in terms of actual physical design, right? Maintaining the look and feel and respecting the look and feel of the community as it was historically, right? Which is, I think, I can personally appreciate versus like a prefab key fob building, like others that look just all look the same and are really flattening and so on. So there's an attempt there from just a physical design perspective, and there's also an attempt, I think, in the Alpine sort of center that they're building, whatever they call it, Alpine Courtyard, where the rents for small businesses are going to be charged by this developer are going to be relatively lower than they might be elsewhere, which also allows them to charge $2 for a cup of coffee rather than $8, right? And so like basically allowing young professionals and small businesses to thrive there and not get priced out immediately, right? Those are two positive things. Now, that doesn't actually Alpine Courtyard is not like, it doesn't extend beyond into like all the rest of the residential neighborhoods, which might still go up in price, which is talked about in the article as well. Like, you cannot prevent just by doing this the pricing out of others in the neighborhood if the development brings in enough interest and desire from others to say like, hey, we're just going to come in, and you know, the free market takes its toll and does gentrification again. However, it's, I think, a well-intentioned attempt on the flip side of some of the other landlord practices that we've seen, even the landlord practices by the way, predated the Alpine Courtyard, because the former residents were actually evicted for a luxury development before this architect came in and bought the development. So it's both, I think, cool in a couple notable ways and different in a couple notable ways. I also don't know if it really addresses all the concerns of gentrification, but it's certainly an interesting and really, I think well-meaning and encouraging attempt to, I think, at least where a landlord, a single developer or a landlord, can control some aspects of what's happening, try to control them in a positive way.
This does look to do some positive things, but it won't ultimately avoid the most pernicious effect of gentrification, which is rising rents and ultimately displacement of communities, right?
Yeah.
And like, my question is, is there anything that can be done for that? Because it seems to me like this feels like the best of a bunch of bad options, meaning like rents are going to rise in Victor Heights no matter what. Obviously, we have a housing shortage in the city. Instead of just having like another salt and straw and another shoe palace in this neighborhood, we're going to actually use it as an opportunity to give up and coming entrepreneurs an opportunity to do something cool. They are also doing stuff for the community. Like, for example, like small gestures, like the coffee shop has a neighborhood price of $2, which honestly, you can't get a $2 cup of coffee at Starbucks these days. So that's a pretty good deal. But, you know, it's in terms of actually avoiding the worst effects of displacement, like that's not really going to happen here. But is this the best of bad options?
I think it may be the best of the best of the options for this particular decision maker, right? For a landowner in this place, right? Who has a different level of decision making power than a city council, right? Or a neighborhood council, right? So I really do think it's a cool attempt. But notably in the article, like, right, so what they're trying to do is preserve, you know, the culture and the setting and the physical architecture of the place. There's literally a quote in the article that says preservation is not just about the buildings, but also the settings and the culture. Theoretically, it's also about the people who are living there, the families who are living there, right?
Yeah.
And it's really, and fair game, a single individual is not responsible for all of that. They can only, he's taking, I think, what he can control. And I do think it's a really cool decision, right? A really cool thing to say, I'm not going to sell out to your Starbucks and your Salt and Straws, who might pay me more for the rent in the spot, but I'm going to prioritize local businesses led by people who represent the neighborhood, right? By people who look like their neighbors and then serve them the foods and the types of cuisines that are represented here. That's really cool. And I don't know if it's all we can ask for, but certainly a really, and I love the neighborhood pricing too. That's a really compelling idea, not one I'd heard of before. But yes, if Victor Heights blows up, right, and they have a big development, a prefab, key fob development coming in not too far away. If it blows up the way Silver Lake does, or the Mohawk, like the Mohawk Bend area of Echo Park, it's going to be hard to stop that, right?
It's not this developer's responsibility to fix gentrification, right? He is not a policymaker. He is not, you know, an elected official. But what I do like here is, yeah, he seems to be approaching things in a responsible way. And it kind of, you know, it kind of makes you wish that like everybody who has some sort of sphere of influence would approach things with the same sense of responsibility almost, as opposed to just like coming into neighborhoods and finding ways to just like make the most money possible. So I don't know, maybe there are lessons that legislators can learn from this in terms of like requirements that they set up for new developers or something. But I think it's a really interesting project and I'm definitely going to be checking it out.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's as simple as this, right? And I think we talked about this last time we discussed this topic, but we can make decisions about what our cities look and feel like, right? We can decide whether we build roads or green space or highways or public transit or whatever it may be, right? And for the most part, I think the reason gentrification has become such an issue is because people aren't trying to make conscious decisions beyond what money, right? Like what, and at no matter the collateral damage to individuals, families, people, and like historic buildings and cultures and like things that we can decide matter to us. And basically this individual is making a decision to say, this matters to me, the architectural, cultural, food, community matters to me, and I'm going to make decisions in a way that prioritizes that, and not decisions that just simply prioritize a bottom line. And that's cool. And we'll see if it can be a model for others.
And he has previous, he restored the Hotel Normandy or preserved it in Koreatown. There is a little bit of like personal incentive going on here, which is he's the owner of Cassell's Hamburgers, which is at the foot of Hotel Normandy and is going to have a location here as well. But hey, I mean, it's not Monsanto.
The most pessimistic view I could take of something like this is that it's like it's like when racism goes from overt to silent, right? It's like, look, it's not going to look like gentrification. I'm not going to say I'm gentrifying, but low key, it's kind of happening. Like that's like the way this could go negatively, where like give me all the credit for making the building look the same, but at the end of the day, in 5 to 10 years. It's going to look like Silver Lake regardless, or it's going to like sell out regardless. I don't know. That again, that's hard pessimistic view, and there are other different decisions that have to be made. But I'd say for now, it's an interesting kind of model, right?
Yeah.
So,
well, I'm excited to see if it works, and if it does, you know, I think we could be seeing this thing popping up in other parts of the city. Look, speaking of other things that are hidden under the surface. Those pesky service fees that we've talked about in the in the past are back in the news. So the Governor Newsom has just signed a law that bans junk fees. And when we talk about junk fees, we're talking about any type of service that the price that's advertised is not actually what you end up paying, because by the time you actually get to swiping your card, there's like, you know, a resort fee and, a service fee. And it's not clear whether restaurants are going to be directly impacted by this, whether they fall under the scope of the legislation. However, they very well could. And it seems like the Attorney General's office is weighing whether to include them. So all of those discussions we had about whether service fees are good, that may be irrelevant. These restaurants may not be able to even do that. What do you think about this?
Yeah, we were a little flippant when we talked about this in the past, saying like, hey, look, stop complaining about service fees at restaurants. Be ready to pay for your meal and pay for staff, et cetera, when you go. But I do think, I mean, look, a more consumer-friendly view is, I think this is good legislation to protect consumers from from essentially hidden fees, right? And what could borderline be called false advertising, saying you're going to pay, here's the ticket price on a thing, but really there's a 30% fee behind it that you don't know about. From what I understand, the question is whether or not the fees for restaurants would be outlawed, right? Whether saying you cannot charge a fee at all, in which case whatever the fee was paying for might be built into them food prices and price of what's on the menu, or whether they're allowed to keep those fees as long as they make them evident on menus and explain what they're used for. And I have to say, particularly in favor of transparency for where those fees go, right? Because they could just be skimmed off the top by managers and owners of businesses, right? They may not go where they're intended to go. So transparency in that way is all good. It seems like well-intended legislation, and I think depending on how exactly it's implemented, will be interesting to see. I'm curious if it is the case that restaurants are not allowed to charge service fees at all, right? Whether or not they're disclosed on menu, whether they have to discharge, incorporate those costs into the price of food or wherever the services are, whatever's on the menu. How that might further impact the restaurant industry. I don't know how that would impact like the inflation of costs or inflation of prices at a restaurant, but that'd be the only thing to see.
My understanding is that maybe yes, they would just have to be more transparent with the service fees, or those costs would just get factored in other ways, or those prices would just get factored in other ways, meaning like instead of paying like $8 for your plate of green lentils, you'll be paying $11 for your plate of green lentils, because restaurants need to make more margins in order to be able to pay their restaurant workers the benefits that were supposed to be going to them through the service fees. I think that the person this really impacts is that dude who made that goddamn spreadsheet.
He's not the only one, to be clear. There are many other people who are, I mean, look, and to be fair, people are like, look, in times of, I think the economy is relatively strong right now, but in times of tight budgets, and really for anyone like in the world who wants to know what they're paying for, of course, service fees are confusing and frustrating. Imagine like this, I think legislation also applies to like ticket buying, right? Mm-hmm. And like when you're like, hey, I thought this ticket was $90, but I'm paying $120 all of a sudden or whatever it is, that's truly impactful, right? And I personally, like as an individual, not knowing much and not having run a restaurant, I like the idea and prefer the idea of restaurants factoring all their costs into their menu, right? Like into the food itself, because like for living wages, for service fees, all of that. Of course, that it makes it difficult in other ways, because by raising the price, demand for your food might be impacted negatively in a way that may not be survivable for your business, right? So sympathy for that challenge for restaurant owners who are already still dealing with supply chain issues and price of food. We talked about pork, like the price of pork and impacting barbecue. So a lot to balance, but I think at the fundamental intent level of people should know what they're paying for, it seems like a good idea. Now, the bullshit part of this is that food delivery platforms got an exception to the legislation, which is really crazy, because they're one of the top, I think, you know, top examples of like egregious fees and hidden fees. I'm going to buy, I'm going to quickly order dinner. It's going to be $35, but I'm going to end up paying 70 because you have delivery fees, service fees, blah, 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 all this different stuff. So notably, that wasn't that catcher was not in the original legislation, but clearly the DoorDash and, you know, Uber Eats lobby, Uber for sure, got in there and carved out an exception for their services, which notable and shady.
Yeah, although I will say, like, it's just good lobbying, bro. It's just good lobbying. Like the National Restaurants Association lobbyists could have done a better job.
Well, I suppose it is just good lobbying. Credit to the shady folks in Sacramento for working for Uber and DoorDash. But yeah, that's some real bullshit, man. It's real bullshit.
That is bullshit. Although I do think like those platforms already do a relatively decent job of telling us what we're paying. They break down the fees and whatnot. So I'm less mad at that. I'm honestly like very interested to see how this all plays out for restaurants. I just don't want, you know, restaurants obviously to suffer from this or to not be able to recoup those costs in some way, shape or form. And I just feel I do worry that like people will see the price of their like pasta carbonara go up from $25 to $30 and be put off by it. But I think then it just becomes a bit of more of a messaging challenge for restaurants. And you know, we can all play a part in that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And real quick on food deliveries, I'm assuming the reason they got their carve out is because, to your point, you see that total price before you click purchase, right? You order your food, you click, I'm about to order, and then they add it all up for you. And then you say, I want to order. Yes, I see all these total costs, and then I order, versus restaurants where you sit down, eat your food, order your food, and then get a check that also already has a service fee on it. So
yeah,
I kind of get where that comes in, but interesting dynamic.
Yeah, yeah. Well, look, I want to talk about some positive things that happened to some restaurants that we very much admire. Holbosch and Poltergeist got really positive reviews. So let's start with Holbosch first. Infatuation LA re-reviewed it and gave it a 9.5 out of 10. Do you think that's a fair and accurate rating?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think so. I'm remembering what Brand told us about their rating system, which is how successful is the restaurant at doing what it's trying to do, right? And I think Holbosch is one of those places that hits all the marks, right? And blows you away. Now, look, of course, you're going back after it was named LA Times Restaurant of the Year. It's kind of like, you know, and kind of a non-controversial high rating at this point. So all good. But yeah, I have no issue. I guess the question I would have is, and I don't know if I can do this on the Infatuation easily, is compare across the rating system, right? Who else is a 9.5, and does that tier seem correct across the board?
Yeah, I'm not sure if they have that capability, although I was kind of comparing it to other spots around town to see how it ranked. And it's like a solid, like, you know, 1.5 points above Galleguetza. It's right. It's one of the, I think, highest rated Mexican restaurants. It's higher than Damian, which I know you quite liked. So, you know, it in terms of like how it stacks up, it's definitely up there. My issue is actually, and I think Holbosch exposes the fundamental flaw in the Infatuation's rating system. And what this means is like, if your rating system is so heavily weighed by how well does this place meet the assignment, Holbosch is a marisco stand at Mercado La Paloma.
Mm-hmm.
This place should be a fucking 14 out of 10. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
Like
yeah,
it is. Its assignment is to serve you an excellent ceviche. It's to, you know, to get you home with a shrimp taco. It is doing one of the best tasting menus in Los Angeles. Come on.
Yeah. I can see that argument. Or you could take it the other way, being like, hey, man, I'm at Mercado La Paloma. I just want a basic hard taco, man. Why are you freaking me out with all this luxury shit? You guys should be in the R District across from Bestia. Bad assignment. Bad assignment.
Yeah, you're like, what is this barnacle? -1 out of 10. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's a good point. Yeah, no, this is more of an infatuation issue than a Holbosch issue. And I think it just exposes how arbitrary all this stuff is. But yeah. I am very, very happy for Holbosch. I do want to talk about the Poltergeist Bill Addison treatment that it received. This is also, it had also received a really good article in Eater not too much before this. You know, it's a good review. It's undoubtedly a good review, right?
Yep.
But the thing that struck me about this one and the Eater review is there is a little bit of hesitation in there, you know?
The hesitation is in that some of the dishes the reviewers feel are not fully successful, which I don't think is unfair. We love Diego. We love Poltergeist. I can't think of a dish that I dislike there. But the whole point of why it's so exciting is because he's trying things that are like mind-blowing. And one of my favorite things about reading the review from Bill was like how blown away he was by the ideas and the creativity and while maintaining the personal connection and personal narrative and like the excitement he has going to Poltergeist. I mean, it really shows how much I think Diego and the work he's doing there are at Button Mash and at Poltergeist is like on the cutting edge of how we even think about food and how creative food can be. And yeah, some of the dishes don't quite hit for Bill, right? That's all good. That's all good. But I do think these are, I think both are, you're right that there's a bit of like a, it's pretty crazy. there's like a little bit of like a pretty, and I think that, look, for what it is today, I guess that's, I don't have an issue with that for someone trying to accurately review what the Poltergeist experience is. I'm just glad the excitement is coming through. I think that's like the main thing.
Yeah, I think restaurants should be rewarded for taking big swings. And if you take big swings, I think you should be graded on maybe not the percentage of dishes that hit, but more so like the way that you're doing it, the things, the ideas, the creativity that you're bringing to it. My one concern for Diego is like when bigwigs at the James Beard Awards, let's say, or the world's 50 best, or, you know, all these places, Michelin even, you know, it's not a Michelin star restaurant, I don't think. I mean, it would be to me, but like based on what we see like on other Michelin guides, you can't really see this getting a star. But my worry is like those kinds of accolades don't necessarily reward intention or big swings or creativity. They reward execution, right? And I don't know. I just worry that in the long run, you need some of those accolades to really make it. Maybe you don't. I don't know.
I see where you're going. I mean, look, to be clear, I mean, at your three Michelin star restaurant, there's just immense creativity too. But I think there's like a familiar creativity, right? And to your point, it's creativity, but then like execution, to your point, is like, I think the highest meter for success. I think what's happening on Poltergeist, and remember, the infatuation did not give Poltergeist a very good review.
Like a 6.3 or something.
Yeah, really low, which is really interesting, again, given their ethos. Diego, to me, is kind of doing a one of one, right? I don't, like, I went to a pop-up in Seattle, which is led by chefs who've worked at Noma and, like, really top world restaurants. They're experimenting, they're trying to use fermentation as a key, the through line idea and be creative in that way. It wasn't very successful. A place that's pushing the envelope as far as Diego is, you're right that, like, look, a place inside Button Mash likely won't get a Michelin star, but I just think it's really exciting to see a place that has that freedom. And who knows, maybe in 10 years, 20 years, whatever, more risks like that will be recognized by a Michelin or a World's 50 Best.
Yeah.
But I think they reward typically like more familiar creativity, so to speak.
And also I said, you know, I was making it sound like, you know, I worry about the future success of the restaurant. And, you know, it's kind of like not all restaurants are designed to operate for 20 years, you know, like, like certain things are meant to like be of a time. And certain chefs also, you know, are very creative driven people. They like to move on to new projects, right? So I think judging it by how well, like taking the infatuation route and judging it by how well it's meeting the current assignment, which it seems like that's what Bill Addison is doing too in his review. I think is the fairest approach. And I think by that measure, few are doing it better.
Yeah, no, I hope Poltergeist becomes the best geologic institution in LA. Like everything about it is so perfect, like from the location and the collaboration with Button Mash and the the freedom that I think Diego would still have to pursue other ideas under this banner. But you're right. I mean, look, as we're seeing this year, and I think Eater just put an article out on about the number of closures we're seeing and like the sea change of closures we're seeing that we've discussed as well. You never know, but I would hope that there's always a home for, and hopefully there's more homes for chefs who are trying things the way Poltergeist is trying them.
Yep. Well, look, we're almost out of time with you here because I know you got other things to do that involve basketball. How do you feel about mole?
I've come around on mole. Typically green and like red moles I like. I know this is a basic bitch take, but chocolate mole is still hard for me. It's still a tough one.
All right. Well, then you absolutely must listen to the upcoming interview we have right after this segment with Gelaguetza owner Bricia Lopez.
Whoa.
Yep. It's a great conversation. And she also gets into why you should never fucking call mole a chocolate sauce. So you're going to particularly like it, I think.
Okay. I did not call it chocolate sauce. Some moles do have chocolate as an ingredient, and those black moles or mole negros or whatever have traditionally been a challenge. I should have taken the bait and gone all in. I hate mole. Just tee you up yet again for a running bit of me accidentally insulting our guest. But Bricia Lopez is a great get, man. I'm excited for that conversation.
Yeah, well, to me, the fact that you even refer to it as chocolate mole, like, indicates that it's sure, in your subconscious, and I think, you're in your head about this, and we'll get you to appreciate it someday, okay? All right, buddy, without further ado, let's do our Yelp review of the week. For listeners who haven't heard this bit before, basically, Father Saul and I share a moment of the past week or couple weeks where we weren't exactly the best versions of ourselves, and our significant others or people in our lives would have been justified in leaving us a shitty Yelp review.
All right. So I think I got a 1.5 star about a week ago because, as you know, and as listeners should know and will learn today, I am an all-world fan of the TV show New Girl. Yeah. So it's one of the things that connected us years ago, and a show I still revisit constantly, all the time. So I'm hanging out, I'm scrolling my Instagram, and it turns out there's a New Girl trivia at a bar in Capitol Hill where I live in Seattle. Very exciting, and I'm like, yo, I'm going to show up. I'm about to crush. And so I sign up. I pay $15 or whatever. I get my girlfriend, who is not a New Girl fan, like really, I'm like, this is happening. It's going to be awesome, and I'm going to be prepared. I spend the prior week actually studying. I'm doing Sporkle quizzes. I'm Googling the hardest New Girl trivia online. Hours and hours of like honing the skills for New Girl trivia. The night comes. I'm prepared. We roll up. A couple things immediately become evident. One, even though the ticket I bought said 7 p.m. start time, on Instagram, they said New Girl trivia 7:30. And I'm in my head, I'm like, okay, so they have like a 30-minute walk up, like, you know, opening, people roll in, 7:30 start time. Turns out it starts at 7. I'm already around late. So far behind. And it's immediately humiliating. I walk in late, and it's like, we walk in late, and I'm the only one, remember, of the two-person party I'm with, the only one who gives a shit about this.
And there's no way you can recoup those points, right?
No way we can recoup those points. So we're an immediate disqualification.
Oh,
right off the bat. Real bummer. However, we show up. I mean, I'm like, should we just bail on this? You're like, all right, no, we're here. Let's stick it out. Realization number two, this is a lesbian bar. I am the only, at least, you know, based on superficial evidence, straight cishet man there, which is kind of hilarious in its own right, given the probably core audience of New Girl and the fact that I'm sticking out like an absolute sore thumb while we're there. Now, despite being late, we talked to the quiz guys up front. We get the questions for the first round. He like sits there, answer the questions, blah, blah, tally up the score. We play the rest of the game, even though we're not qualified to win. Game goes to the very end. There's like a sudden death round because two teams are tied for first place, blah, blah, blah. It ends. The tally of the scores, bro, if I was on time, I would have won that shit straight up.
No way.
Yeah. And so not only am I late, am I like, you know, sticking, I'm in a community that, or in a bar that, you know, shouldn't be in, but I'm kind of like taking up space. It was a funny thing because as they would go through each round, they would be like, hey, here's this question. Who has the answer? People would yell out, like, you know, people would yell out the answer to the question. And there would be a couple times, because I know more than everyone, that no one would say the answer, and I knew the answer. However, I'm being quiet because I can't just hear one guy go, it was Schmidt, like in a bar in a bar full of, you know, gay women having a nice night out. Didn't want to take up too much space. And at the very end, it's like the fucking ruined orgasm of not winning when I should have fucking won if I showed up on time.
It's brutal. Fair.
1.5 stars.
I think it's fair because, you know, it would have been like fucked up for you to win. I think it's not your space. It's not your night, you know? So
that's right.
It would have been like, it just wouldn't have been appropriate for you to win. I think that, you know, 1.5 stars. Yeah. 1.5 stars is fair because honestly, like the moment that you had zero chance left of winning, I think it would have been the right move as the partner to leave because Emily had no like vested interest in this. Her only vested interest was just to see you win and you couldn't even win. So staying felt even more selfish. Not to mention like, I don't think either of you are like, are really into alcohol at this moment in time. So like, it's not like you were even getting wasted. So this was literally just like pure love from her, which gives you a 1.5 out of 5.
She really had to stick it out. I think she would have been happy, like, from a competition aspect, she would have been happy. And look, I will say, I think it was proper in the end that I was not like the one straight dude standing up there being like, I fucking win, you idiots. Like, that's a bad, maybe like a bad look at Wild Rose in Seattle. But I also thought it would have been so fucking funny if in this room full of like queer women, the straight guy wins New Girl Trivia. Unfortunately, it was not meant to be. And I dragged Emily humiliating through a Tuesday night in Seattle.
You'll get him next time, buddy. You'll get him next time. Okay, real quick, my bad Yelp review of the week. So Morgan, my wife, has been telling me for literally months, maybe years, to get a AAA membership. She's like, do it, do it, do it. Literally reminds me every few weeks, every time we see like a broken down car on the side of the road, she's like, you got your AAA membership, right? And I kind of do the thing where like I'm not lying to her, but I'm not confirming it either. I'm like, and so I'm at my soccer game on Tuesday night, and it's a late one. You know, we start at like 8 p.m. or something. It goes to 9:30. Usually Morgan's asleep by the time I come home. And first of all, we get absolutely pumped. We lose like 8-0, right? So I'm already like in a horrifically foul mood, and I get back to my car and it won't start. My car will not start. And first thing I think is, oh no, Morgan's gonna kill me because I did not sign up for AAA. So I'm forced to call my wife at 9:30 p.m., which sounds early, but to her it's like 2 a.m. She's a very early sleeper. And, you know, I wake her up out of a dead ass sleep and get her to help me in this predicament. Needless to say, I don't hear the end of it. And I think the most embarrassing part is that when the mechanic finally arrived, it was like the easiest fix of all time. Like, so like my battery was fine. It was literally like I put the key in wrong. Like literally like the dumbest thing ever. So I think this is probably a one star moment for me personally. But what would you give me?
I was thinking half star for most of this. I was at one star for the waking up and for the not listening to directions and like the kind of lying about having signed up for AAA, but not really. Then waking her up for basically something that you could have solved yourself after all that. That's a half star, buddy. That's pretty rough.
It's pretty low. It's pretty low. Well, look, thanks again, Father Saw, for joining us. This has been an absolute riot.
Anytime you'd have me, man. And you know, next time I'm in LA, whenever that may be, I'll see you when I see you.
All right, man. Go watch the Sixers. Talk to you soon. Joining us today on the LA Food Podcast is an entrepreneur and author extraordinaire whose family restaurant, Gelaguetza, has propelled Oaxacan cuisine to new heights in Los Angeles and beyond. It's Bricia Lopez. Bricia, how are you doing today?
Hi. Yes, that's me. I'm doing wonderful. Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh my God. Thank you for joining us. Where are you calling us from? What are your LA stomping grounds?
I am actually at Gelaguetza right now at my restaurant.
That's awesome. You're doing it live from the scene.
Live from Gelaguetza.
I love it. What's Gelaguetza like at 11 a.m. on a Thursday or Friday?
Friday. I mean, it's, we have a great breakfast crowd. We are open for breakfast Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Our restaurant is divided, and I always say, yeah, two sections. So the front section is pretty busy right now. I'm in the back area. And this is the back area that we use usually. We get people flowing in here more for dinner during the weekday and weekend.
Yeah. So if somebody has never been to Galaguetza for breakfast, what would you recommend they try?
Oh my gosh. I love huevos divorciados, which are essentially, and translated would be divorced eggs. So there's an egg in the middle, and then you have chilaquiles on the left that are red chilaquiles, and chilaquiles on the right that are green chilaquiles. So you get the best of both worlds with like a nice runny egg in the middle. You can't go wrong with eggs and chilaquiles, I would say.
Totally. No, I think that that could cure just about any hangover, any sort of like case of the Mondays. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So let's start at the very beginning. And because you're a Galaguetza, it's a perfect place to start. So your family, if I understand correctly, opened Galaguetza in 1994.
Yes.
How did that come about?
I don't know how my father did it. He did it. Obviously, he figured it out. And I think that is, I always say that is every restaurant owner's superpower is just we figure shit out. We just do it. We just have to figure it out. My dad moved to LA, and like you said, in 94, he was a food vendor. And by that, it's not, he started not by having a food stand, but by actually going door to door and selling Oaxacan products. So my mom, and myself and my siblings, we would all take turns. We would go with my mom. We were living in Oaxaca back then when my dad was living here in LA. And we would go to the central market in Oaxaca, Central de Abastos, and we would buy Oaxacan items that, you know, basic survival needs for any Oaxacan, clayudas, chapulines, tasajo, quesillo, mole, chocolate. We'd put them in boxes. We'd ship them out to him, to Tijuana. My dad would drive to Tijuana, pick them up, and then find the Oaxacan community living here in LA and all over Los Angeles County, all the way up to Santa Maria, Santa Barbara. He would drive. And he would just go and deliver food products. And they got to know him. And he became the guy who would sell clayudas and the guy that would sell Oaxacan food. Eventually, that led him to open up a food stand in the street in the corner of 8th Street in Arolo. He did that for a few months. And then figured somehow, by the grace of God, without knowing how to speak English or knowing any sort of health code, figured out how to open a restaurant in Los Angeles. And he had his first restaurant. Tiny place. He only had 4 or 6 tables. And after having that place open for a few months, he decided to fly out his family and start a new life here with his 4 children and his wife. And that's what we did.
And how old were you at the time?
I was 10 years old when I moved to LA from Oaxaca.
Wow. So big change for you at 10 years old.
Huge change. Yeah.
What was your memory like of those early days at the old Galaguetza?
Oh, I mean, it was just community. It was, you know, doing my homework there every day. It was every after school. It was always being surrounded by beautiful people that looked like me. I think the reason why I'm so attached to my culture and the reason why I'm so in tune with who I am as a person and as my heritage, it's because of the restaurant. It's because I was always championed by my Oaxacan community, and it was beautiful. And we would always celebrate Day of the Dead, and we would always celebrate we would celebrate La Galaguetza. We would celebrate so many Oaxacan celebrations with our community, and our food was, I ate great every single day. But I also witnessed a lot of struggle with my parents, you know, work. I was able to witness what work ethic looked like, or, you know, what hard work and grind looked like, physical labor looked like. And also a lot of sad things, for example, me not being able to do after school activities and me going to school and, you know, sitting down and hearing all these kids, rich kids. I went to a school in a very prominent neighborhood here in Los Angeles. And I went to school in Brentwood. I did not live in Brentwood and I was not rich, but the kids around me were. So, you know, a lot of self-awareness of I was very different. You know, every Monday, everybody would come home, everybody come to school and share all the wonderful things they did. And even after, you know, winter vacation or summer vacation, where they went on vacation. And I was just like, yeah, I was just hanging out at the restaurant the entire time, you know? Mm-hmm. But I think at the end of it, all beautiful memories of just my family being together working.
Did you have aspirations back then of continuing to work in the restaurant, or
never?
Did you want, never? You were like, this isn't for me. I want to go out and do something else.
No, of course not. I mean, I don't think any 6 year old, you know, I mean, 6 year old, any 10 year old, you know, is sitting at a restaurant, you know, table, looking at, witnessing how hard their parents are working. And I always felt like the restaurant was really stealing my family time or not being able to go on vacation. I mean, I have a really great friend who's a wonderful chef who started his career in food as a 12-year-old as a dishwasher and found his calling and never went back. That was not the case for me. I was dishwashing at 12 and I was like, I hate every part of this and I don't want to do this.
That sounds normal.
Yeah, that sounds more normal than his story. But I think I didn't really find my calling for the restaurant until, or you know, my early 20s when I realized it wasn't, you know, I wasn't meant to just be, you know, a line cook or a hostess or a waitress. My calling was more about championing my culture, and it just became very different for me.
That's awesome. Was there anything you were looking to do before you decided to do that? Like, were you pursuing a different career path?
I never fully pursued a different career path. I went to school for business administration, but I always had dreams of being a graphic designer. I love design. I love marketing. I had a lot of fun in my marketing class, but I never really worked anywhere to pursue that.
Well, your passion for design certainly comes through in how beautiful your books are.
Thank you.
The Oaxaca book, even if you never cooked a recipe out of it, one of the most beautiful things you can have on your coffee table. So at what point did you actually decide or get the opportunity to kind of jump into the restaurant as more of your sort of like, you know, adult career?
Adult self. Yeah. Well, yeah. It was when my parents retired. When they retired and, you know, also at that same time, the businesses were going through bankruptcy and we were going to lose every single thing. And my siblings and I got together and realized that the best, that our next step would be to save my parents' legacy. So we dug it out of bankruptcy and we worked very, very hard. I mean, this was about 10 years ago, I think. And I think the first few years was just brutal because it was one debt after the next and then getting hit with another IRS letter and getting hit by this and getting hit by that. And right, you know, as soon as we thought we were digging ourselves out of the hole, something else would happen. So it was really difficult, really challenging, but ultimately we got to the place that we were at zero and then we were able to rebuild from there. So it's a lot of struggle, but I think working with my siblings has been the biggest blessing of my life, working with my family, who are also my best friends, and all, you know, every day having the same goal and the same vision together was, you know, has been the biggest gift I've received. And it's beautiful. And we're all here, you know, now building the business, and from there it has shifted and we've launched new businesses together since then. And yeah, it's been a journey of 10 years.
10 years ago, from what I can recall, and I moved to Los Angeles in 2009, and Gelaguetza was very much the place, you know, people told you to go to if you wanted to try Oaxacan cuisine. And, you know, I remember reading Jonathan Gold articles about how it was, you know, a place where all even the Oaxacan dignitaries and politicians would go to when they were in town. So, you know, a lot of people see that and associate it with success, right? They're like, oh my God, this restaurant is experiencing incredible success. But you say that, you know, the restaurant was facing bankruptcy and really tough times. Can you square that for our listeners who might not understand, like, how can a restaurant be experiencing that much success yet go through such challenging times?
You know, I think that there's a misconception about restaurants, period. I think that people go into a restaurant and they see it's busy and they see it's this or that. And they always equate someone has a restaurant as successful. And oh my gosh, it must be so rich. But restaurants work in a very, very small margin. I think even today, in today's standards, unless you have more than 5 restaurants open at the same time, which is very, very hard, you know, it's hard to make a living. And I don't think people really understand the economics of restaurants. But yes, it's very challenging. There's a lot of people that it takes a lot of people to make the experience every single day. It's hard.
What steps did you have to take to turn the ship around at that point?
Oh my gosh. Well, I mean, we had to, you know, obviously figure out who was stealing from us, who was not really, you know, being their best self every day at work, and had to reimagine our operations, had to reimagine our staff, had to reimagine, you know, how we operated, and, you know, and then have fun at the same time. You know, we did a lot of fun things, a lot of fun activations. We actually were one of the first, if not the first restaurant to have a mural outside the restaurant. We had so many beautiful friends at Oaxaca who are incredible artists who came and did a lot of artwork here at the restaurant and used that as marketing. And I think this was also at the time when Twitter was just really popping off and social media was just becoming the thing, and became a lot of friends with a lot of people who helped us really find our voice on the internet. And, you know, and then we were able to kind of gather a whole new generation of people that never heard of the restaurant. To this day, there's a lot of people who've never been here. LA is so big, and people are always flowing in, coming through LA and moving in and moving out. So being a restaurant, a legacy restaurant that's been open for almost 30 years, you know, some might think, oh, it's easy for you because you've been there and, you know, established and you don't have to do much. But it's, I think, almost just as hard, if not harder, to be able to reinvent yourself over and over again and let you know, have people, new people come in.
Yeah, totally. It's like, and as you said, you're a legacy restaurant, but you do feel like you're always doing new things and you're, you know, you're constantly bringing in new products. How do you strike that balance between honoring that legacy and being this historic restaurant and wanting to keep things fresh and exciting and drawing those new people in?
Well, I just think I'm me. I think that's just who we are. I think that, you know, I can only speak out my experience and who I am as a person, and that just happens to be reflected in what we do every day.
Well, speaking of your food and your products and what you're famous for, I wanted to get into the world of mole a little bit because, you know, we have a lot of a diverse group of listeners, and maybe there are some who aren't as familiar with the concept of mole. And I was wondering if you could just give a quick description for those people, what we're talking about when we talk about mole and how it's made.
I always lead the conversation of mole with one thing. If it's one thing you learn out of this podcast, if you're listening, is mole is not a chocolate sauce. It's like the worst thing you could ever call it. So just please, please, please do not ever refer to it as a chocolate sauce. Mole is a very complex sauce, perfectly seasoned, and it's a combination, a song of many ingredients that strike the perfect balance of umami that's savory, sweet, salty. And yes, there is some sort of chocolate in there as a seasoning, just the way that you would use honey in a marinara sauce is the same way that you use chocolate in a mole sauce to kind of hit that perfect balance. But you would never refer to marinara sauce as a honey sauce, right? Or even a barbecue sauce has brown sugar. You wouldn't refer to it as a brown sugar sauce. You would just, as you know, it's just a barbecue sauce, or it's just a curry sauce. It's just mole.
And obviously mole is served, it can be served in a number of different ways. But what do you think is the best way for people to go in and enjoy it, especially for the first time if they haven't had it?
I think the most traditional way to enjoy mole, and you do the same thing in Oaxaca, and is just having a big plate of just mole with just really nice poached chicken and white rice. You let the mole shine. We never put cream or any sort of dairy on top. It's just the mole. But my favorite way of having it is in a tamal. The mole is my favorite thing, just because you have that beautiful masa. It's, you know, has it's rendered obviously with pork fat, but, you know, have that fattiness and beautiful velvety texture of the masa, but also contrasted that with the smoky black mole and then chicken, of course, as the protein. But that's my favorite way of having moles, in a tamal de mole for sure.
Oh my God, you're making me hungry, Patricia. You've also launched a line of your own moles that you sell outside of the restaurant,
yes.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm curious how that venture has gone and sort of any challenges you've come across in terms of like bringing mole to the masses, if you will.
Well, I don't think it's quite there yet. I don't think we've reached the masses per se. Mole also, you know, it's a laborious work. It does not take days to make, but it is an effort. And if you're making it from scratch, does take a few hours, especially roasting the chiles. So we launched a line of mole starters, which is essentially a sort of paste It's a paste that you just put as the base. You add chicken broth, you add some tomato sauce for acidity, and you have mole in less than 10 minutes. So we do all the hard work for you. We have them in 16-ounce pouches and in 12-ounce jars that are huge for the holidays. And they're the best gift you can give someone. So I highly encourage to visit ilovemolestore.com and gift your loved one some mole for the holidays. And yeah, it's been fun. We have them available through our online store and also through a lot of small grocer retails across the country.
That's awesome. Well, I know what will be appearing in the stockings of my loved ones this holiday season.
Yes.
So let's move on from mole, because you've not just helped popularize that outside of the Mexican communities in America, but also you've had a big role with mezcal. In fact, you've been called the queen of mezcal, if I'm not mistaken.
I'm
curious, how do you get to be called the queen of mezcal? I that's a great title.
Oh, that's funny. I don't know a life without mezcal. I guess that's the best way of saying about my relationship with mezcal. I've always had mezcal. It's always been part of me. It's always been who I am. When my father opened Guelaguetza, he was probably one of the first people to pour mezcal in a setting like this. We had this, you know, big restaurant and the first person to actually have a mezcal program. And I think it's just based on who I am. I think the way that came about is I obviously, like I said, have a very big love for mezcal, but before mezcal was cool, before bartenders and, you know, people in the food industry really, really understood mezcal, I would mail mezcal samples to a lot of my friends who were in the industry, and I would never be promoting a brand. It was always just to promote mezcal, and I would always encourage people to go in with the, honestly, my mission there was for them to want to go to Oaxaca and want them to understand. And obviously I just felt proud of my culture, and I just wanted people to like taste it. And I was from Oaxaca, and I mean, I am from Oaxaca, and I have a Oaxacan restaurant. So for me, it was more of a way of championing my culture and sharing it with the world. And there's no reason why you wouldn't fall in love with mezcal. So a lot of people, obviously, when they had mezcal questions, came to me. I introduced many people to different producers. And, you know, that was one part of my life. I am really not that much involved with mezcal anymore. I don't have a brand. I'm not associated with any brand. I just like to consume it when I go to Oaxaca a lot.
Totally. Well, I actually wanted to talk to you about Oaxaca for a moment, because there's been an increasing, at least in the past like 5 years on my Instagram feed, an increasing number of folks heading to Oaxaca to, you know, spend a weekend or spend, mm-hmm. you know, a couple yeah. weeks. And it's a super easy trip from Los Angeles.
It is.
How would you tackle, for as a first timer, a weekend trip to Oaxaca? What are the must do's and must sees? And that's probably an impossible question.
Yeah. Well, from LA, this is the LA food podcast. The way I fly to LA, there's one airline that does a direct flight. The airline's called Volaris. They're not my favorite airline, but they get you there in 4.5 hours and it's one shot. So no complaints about that. Mm-hmm. There's no Wi-Fi or anything like that. And their food service is very limited to cup of noodles and, you know, cookies. So just plan accordingly.
Bring a book and a Clif Bar and you'll be fine.
Yes. So I would say that their direct flights every Friday, Monday and Wednesday, Monday, Wednesdays and Fridays. So if you're doing a weekend, you would fly out of LAX noon. That will put you in Oaxaca just in time for dinner. So I would do a really nice, I would go check in my hotel, shower, freshen up, do a really fancy dinner, or I wouldn't say fancy, but go to a very nice restaurant, a very nice dinner to welcome yourself into Oaxaca, whether that be Casa Oaxaca, that would be Origen, that would be Los Anzantes, just to be served and to just really experience Mexican hospitality and Oaxacan cooking in its highest form. Mm-hmm. And after that, go hit up a mezcal bar, or, you know, go and linger in a bar and have fun and dance. Wake up the next day, which will be Saturday, and just explore the town. Walk around, you know, El Centro, walk around and experience different places. Go visit a mercado, take a food tour. Take a cooking class. I mean, there's so many things that you can do. And at nighttime, again, go to another nice dinner. Or go hit up, like, there's my favorite place to have tacos in Oaxaca. It's called Lechoncito de Oro. The only place I will only have tacos. Oaxaca is not a taco place. And again, go, maybe there's a place called Xalaparta, which is a club of sorts that you will be dancing and having lots of fun. And then Sunday, maybe go out, explore. I love Tlacolula Sunday Market. It's one of my favorite markets to experience. You really get to see the culture. And, you know, after Tlacolula, go to Mitla, go to Yerbalagua, come back to Oaxaca. And, you know, head out the next day at 7. I think the flight leaves at 8 a.m. on Monday and then puts you back in L.A. at noon. And then that's it.
This is amazing. You basically just gave us like a 36 hours in Oaxaca New York Times story for free. So thank you. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
You were awarded in 2014 or 15, if I'm not mistaken,
15,
the James
15.
Beard. 15, 15. The
That's
James
a long
time Beard. Ago. I mean, it could be like yesterday, you know, James Beard Classics Award. What did that? That's a huge honor. I'm curious, what did it mean for you and your family to receive that award?
Oh, it was just such a milestone in our life and our family history. And I think not just for our family, but obviously, you know, also for the Oaxacan community in general, even just for the Mexican American community in general. When you take an indigenous restaurant, an indigenous family from Oaxaca and award them such a coveted and important prize and recognition. It's not a prize, sorry. Such an important recognition. For my father to be able to go on stage and receive the award, give his speech in Spanish, and for him to champion a lot of Oaxaqueños who, you know, work in the restaurant industry. You know, most of Mexicans and Mexican immigrants, Central Americans, but specifically Oaxaqueños, they're the backbone of this industry, and you will always find a Oaxaqueño in every kitchen throughout the country. So I think a lot of chefs also gave us a lot of respect, and it was beautiful. I got to meet so many of the people that I've looked up to, but I also got to like just hang out and, you know, dress up and, you know, be in a beautiful, fancy hotel and have the best time with my family. It was a wonderful experience.
That's incredible. Was this in New York at the time?
Chicago. It was the first time they had moved into Chicago.
First time they moved to Chicago. And did you have any starstruck moments?
I mean, I think my only starstruck moment was when I met Jose Andres. And since then, he's become a great friend, who's a person who I look up to many, many ways. But yeah, definitely him.
That's awesome. Yeah. Huge fan of Jose Andres. Awesome. Well, look, I wanted to make sure we leave time to talk about Asada, your latest book, because you truly are a definition of a Renaissance woman. You've done everything from launch your own product lines to co-founding the amazing organization ReHer. We had Lynn Ta on the podcast a few weeks ago, and she told us all about that incredible organization. But as I just mentioned, you're also a best-selling author, known for your book that I mentioned before, Oaxaca, and most recently, Asada. I'd like to talk a little bit about Asada because I think it's a really cool, unique concept. I'd love to know, what inspired this book?
Well, you know, Oaxaca, as you said, really was a culmination of my family's history. When you read the first, you know, 20 pages of the book, I know it's a cookbook, but it does have a beautiful story in the beginning. And it's the story that I just told about, and all the details about my dad's history, my dad's struggle, our family's transition from one generation to the next, about my love for Oaxaca, our love for Oaxaca. And it really is just about my family. Asada to me was my life after moving to LA and my life of understanding what really being a Mexican American was and embracing my Americanness, embracing my LA-ness, my LA-ness. I don't know how you would call that, the Latina, the LA Latina inside of me, and being able to not, and really take myself out of the box of just being a Oaxacan girl, but, you know, being something else and being able to be both my best Latina LA girl with my hoops and doing asadas on the weekends and, you know, just really a celebration of Mexican culture in Los Angeles. So that really is what Asada is all about.
That's awesome. So for those who don't know about the concept of having an asada, can you describe what that means?
It's a gathering of people, a gathering of friends, a gathering of just everything surrounding food. It's a cookout of sorts, but with our Mexican, our best Mexican selves forward. It's not just meat, it's ceviche, It's chicken, it's pork, it's gelatinas, it's desserts, it's chicharrones, it's everything around, you know, Mexican American culture in LA.
So yeah, it's not the, you know, you go to a truck and you order asada. This means you're having a party. It's the gathering.
Yes, correct.
What does Bricia Lopez's ideal asada spread look like?
Oh man, well, you would have chicharron, you would have all the cheeses, you would have carne asada, which is like just a traditional carne asada. You would have pollo asado, you would have ceviche, tortillas, both flour and corn, black beans, red rice, and green rice, and at least four salsas.
At least four salsas. All homemade, I'm assuming, right?
Yeah, yes, of course.
Yeah, of course. We're not messing around with anything pre-made. That's awesome. And is this, I'm assuming there's probably some alcohol involved at these gatherings.
Micheladas always.
Yeah. What's the secret to a good michelada?
I mean, you'd have to just use the mix that I produce. I love micheladas.com.
So that's the secret. There you go. You figured it out.
Yes.
Okay. Finally, I just wanted to say I've really enjoyed your videos with Javier Cabral of LA Taco, where you guys are going around and trying all these different taco spots. What are some taquerias you've been digging lately?
Well, the ones that I recently posted about, I forgot the actual neighborhood. Oh, I'm blanking out. But Taconazo in Bell Gardens, I think it was. That was really a surprise. It's a wonderful, wonderful, beautiful fish taco. Tacos El Cachetón, that where we went last time, that asada was beyond I ever had, but we had lip taco that was very soft and just melted in your mouth, and it was just wonderful. And Tacos La Carreta in Long Beach, I believe those I would say right now my top three.
That's awesome. Yeah, I got to go to Tacos La Carreta last year, and I remember their choreados really sending me to another planet. I'd never had one before.
So good.
Yeah. And where are you eating besides Galaguetza when you're not doing taco crawls with Javier?
Oh my gosh. Where am I eating? That is such a good question. I just really go everywhere. I mean, for Mexican food, I love Chichen Itza. I love Holbox. Chef Gilberto is one of my favorite chefs here in LA. That's a Mexican food. Outside of that, I love anything Ori makes. I love Safi's. I love Bestia. I love Babel. I love Stephanie Izard's plays, The Girl and the Goat. I haven't really been in LA much this summer, but I'm looking forward to trying a lot of new restaurants that are opening up. So if you have any recommendations, let me know.
Oh my God, I've got nothing but recommendations. So I'll definitely be sharing those with you at some point. Well, Bricia, for the people at home who are looking to learn more, where can they find you? Online.
You can just
of course,
find me
not in person.
Yeah, just on Instagram at Bricia Lopez. I am very active there, on TikTok at Bricia Lopez, and you can just find me there. I'm very easy to find.
Well, thank you very much for making time for our podcast
today.
Thanks really
for
enjoyed
me.
The conversation.
No, yeah, same.
Thanks for listening to another episode of the LA Food Podcast. Thanks to our guest, Bricia Lopez of Galaguetza. Make sure to go check out her book, her moles, her michelada mixes, and most of all, Galaguetza if you haven't already. Thanks also to Father Saul for deigning us with his presence after all these weeks. We enjoyed his dulcet tones and immaculate storytelling. If you like what you heard today, dear listener, please go to wherever you listen to podcasts, leave us a rating, a review, subscribe. We would be eternally grateful. It turns out those things really help us get up the charts on Spotify and Apple and bring our content to even more listeners. We'll be back with another epic episode next week. But in the meantime, if you're looking for me, you can find me on Instagram, TikTok, and even Threads at the LA Countdown. That's THELACOUNTDOWN. You can also find me on Instagram at LA Food Pod. That's LAFOODPOD.